From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the Leonard Lopate Show. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is just one segment of our show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand. Created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Rory Stewart's last book was a bestseller called The Places in Between. It was about his trek, mostly on foot, across Afghanistan shortly after the U.S. invasion. If you thought he would never be able to top that, well, then you have some catching up to do, because in August 2003, Mr. Stewart, a former British Foreign Service officer, took a taxi from Jordan to Baghdad, hoping to land a job in occupied Iraq. And he wound up being appointed the interim governorate coordinator of an entire province in the southeastern part of the country. He's recorded his experiences in his new book from Harcourt Press called The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq. And I'm very pleased to welcome Mr. Stewart to my show today. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
What sort of job were you looking for?
Well, I'd worked previously in Afghanistan and Indonesia and Yugoslavia, and I was hoping to find a job where I could contribute in some way towards the reconstruction of the country and try to use some of the knowledge I'd picked up from walking for 20 months from Turkey to Bangladesh and staying in 500 different village houses.
Well, I wonder why you went directly to Baghdad. Couldn't you just send in a job application from Britain?
I had, actually. I'd been sending in my resume for about 5 months and nobody had paid any attention, so I thought it was better to go there in person.
And I just read about two kids from Boston who took a taxi to Baghdad looking for work, so I guess a lot of people are doing this.
I think it was the thing to do at the time.
In case I ever need a new job, how much did the taxi cost?
A taxi cost about $35 from Amman to Baghdad.
Did you have any contacts in the capital or just show up?
I had some contacts because I'd been in the Foreign Service, so I was going to see people who I'd worked with previously in the Balkans particularly.
And what was the situation in Baghdad at that time? This is August 2003?
Mm-hmm. Well, what shocked me first, I spent the first week I was there just walking around the old city and basically being a tourist, going to see some of the great old mosques and visiting the great seminary, which has been there for 800 years. What struck me first of all was the extraordinary level of almost immediate hostility that I encountered just walking through the market. Whereas in Kabul, I was used to having gone in there just 2 months after the invasion to people being at least relatively open and receptive to the possibility that the coalition might have improved things. In Iraq, almost from the moment I arrived, people seemed to be extremely resistant to the presence of foreigners in their country.
They saw it as an occupation right from the start, then?
That was very much my understanding. I mean, there may have been a brief honeymoon period, but it was so brief that my guess is that basically people at root had very strong nationalist feelings and perhaps even religious feelings against the foreign presence in their country.
So how did you land the job as interim governorate coordinator? It's very hard to say. Coordinator of the province of Maysan.
Well,
As I say,
I'm a professional British diplomat and I'd served nearly 7 years in post-conflict countries and in the Islamic world and had just spent 20 months walking across most of Islamic Asia. So I suppose they hired me for two reasons. Firstly, because I had some expertise in the Islamic world and post-conflict countries, but secondly, because nobody else really wanted to do the job.
Well, you didn't speak Arabic.
I didn't speak Arabic. I speak Farsi, which helped me because I was on the Iranian border and I was dealing predominantly with people who had been stationed in Iran for nearly 20 years.
This is also the area where much of the war between Iran and Iraq had taken place.
Devastated area. I was based in the Marsh Arab regions, and Saddam, of course, had drained the marshes, destroying this 5,000-year-old, perhaps even older culture of people living on floating platforms of reeds and reed houses with their buffaloes and hunting with tridents. These people in the decade before I arrived there had largely been pushed out of those areas and were living in slums on the edge of big modern cities, doing very menial jobs. and were very closely connected with extreme Islamist militia groups.
Many different kinds. We would assume, because they're Shiites, that there would be connections to Iran, and you said many had lived in exile in Iran, but not everyone was connected to Iran, and there are the Sadrists.
That's absolutely right. I mean, there were basically three different kinds of groups that we were dealing with from the beginning, although it was disguised. It took some time to work this out. 54 new political parties had emerged in the 4 months between the invasion and the time when I first turned up, and these had included splinter groups called things like the Party of God Iraq faction, the Movement of the Party of God, the Muslim Islamic Call faction, the Movement of the Islamic Call, the Islamic Call Iraq Tendency, and even Iraqis.
Tendency?
Yeah, there was Hizb Dawa Tanzim al-Iraq. And the problem, even for Iraqis, in trying to decipher the ideology, the leadership, the motivations of these groups was extreme. But eventually, it became apparent there were basically three types of groups. There were tribal groups, often quite secular and nationalist and rural in nature. Secondly, there were groups very closely connected to Iran, so that the Skirian Badr brigades were led by people who'd spent, most of them, one or two decades living in Iran, and units officered by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, and many of them still taking money from the Iranian government weekly. And finally, of course, the Sadrist movement, which initially we were told by most of the Iraqis that we dealt with on a daily basis didn't matter. Iraqi interlocutors often said these people, Muqtada Sadr is a young radical, nobody respects him, they only talk to him because of his father, the only people who support him are illiterate people, forget about him. And when the election came, it turned out they got three times as many votes as the next nearest party.
Even though Muqtada al-Assad is in Baghdad, isn't he? And also in Sadr City, far away.
Absolutely. He turned out he had a very strong national following. The Sadrist party, which defined itself as an Islamist, very conservative Islamist party in terms of its social codes, also defined itself as a nationalist anti-Iranian party despite taking money from Iran. I mean, this was a very complicated situation.
I've always understood that this area was more tribal than it was political, and that tribal connections were the most important consideration. But is that changing?
Well, that of course, is changing. For many Iraqis, saying that southern Iraq is a tribal society would be like a Scot saying that Scotland is a clan society. A lot of the people living in the cities, if you said which tribe you were from, would say, what on earth are you talking about? You know, I'm a modern man. I've got no idea who my tribal chief is, and I pay no attention to him whatsoever. The tribal chiefs themselves, of course, presented things in very different ways. They would turn up and say, my name is Sheikh Sa'ad bin Abdul Wahid bin Faleh bin Majid bin Khalifa. My grandfather was in the marshes with Wilfred Thesiger in 1953. I controlled 10,000 men, build a clinic in my area. And then be followed, perhaps 2 hours later, by their first cousin, who claimed that he, rather than them, was in fact the leader of the party.
My guest is Rory Stewart, whose latest book is The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, published by Harcourt. And it was your job, you write, to exercise all executive, legislative, and judicial authority in the province. Now, here you are, 30 years old, and the total ruler of a province of Iraq?
This was the Coalition Provisional Authority. So what had happened...
So you were assigned to be that, but that doesn't mean you actually had those powers?
Well, what this meant is that the coalition had panicked, basically, after the invasion, having originally intended to hand over immediately to an Iraqi government the chaos and the looting that they encountered in Baghdad in April 2003, led them to impose a direct administration, which really, in form, was almost a pseudo-colonial administration, although it was backed by a UN resolution. And as you say, technically, under this resolution, all executive, legislative, and judicial authority rested with the coalition, rested with people such as myself, and then later with my American boss, who was a State Department officer.
Because you really were hired to be her deputy, but she hadn't arrived.
Exactly. And we reported jointly to Ambassador Bremer in Baghdad, who's, of course, the senior American administrator. So this was a theoretical position. In practice, of course, in many ways, we were lost. We were in an extremely remote provincial province, which very few Iraqis really understood the political structures of, and we were struggling to deal with these 54 parties, these 14 tribal groups, and towards the end, with people besieging us, flinging in mortars, rocket-propelled grenades. Later, I was transferred to the neighboring province of Dikar in Nasiriyah, where I worked alongside an Italian colleague, And there the problems became even more extreme. There, essentially, we were facing an all-out insurgency.
So the people really did not react well to your appointment. Did it matter to them whether you were British or American?
I think for Iraqis, many of them would prefer to deal with an American because they perceive the Americans correctly as spending 90% of the money in Iraq and taking 99% of the decisions.
What about your boss, Molly Fee, an American? She arrived 5 weeks after you did. Did she find it difficult engaging some of the political leaders in Maysan because she was a woman?
I think Molly was a very respected figure. She did a very good job and she worked very hard. I mean, she's a serving State Department officer, so it's not really my business to talk about my boss or my colleague.
Oh, but she's not your boss anymore.
Oh, my ex-boss.
What's the major city in the area?
The major city is a city called Alamara, and then the next city I moved to was called Nasiriyah. These places had populations, in the case of Nasiriyah, of nearly 800,000 people.
So that's a big city.
Almost no sewerage system, electricity about 4 hours a day, unemployment rates of between 70 and 80%. And we were being given $10 million in cash to spend by April. And simply dispersing this money, trying to create jobs, trying to create some kind of economic growth, proved to be incredibly challenging.
You've named your book after Abu Hatim, the Prince of Marshes. Who was he?
He was a very glamorous figure in some ways. He had been the most famous resistance leader against Saddam, based in the marshes, operating out of this strange waterland region in which he hid and mounted attacks on Ba'athist convoys, assassinated Iraqi generals. He was arrested, imprisoned in Abu Ghraib, and was one of the only men to actually escape from Abu Ghraib.
Now, was he fighting Saddam Hussein on political grounds or because Saddam was draining the marshes and trying to change the area?
I think his opposition to Saddam was primarily that of a Shia leader who felt that his own tribal group was under threat and who felt that there was a better kind of Iraq. An Iraq which, in fact, in Abu Hatim's mind, would still have been quite an authoritarian, quite a nationalist country, but which would have been a country without Saddam. In the early days, the Prince of the Marshes defined himself as an anti-Iranian. He was very concerned about Iranian influence, and he was also very scathing about the Sadrist movement, who he dismissed as being essentially an illiterate rabble. By the end, he'd changed his position considerably. He'd begun to realize that, in fact, these Islamist parties, both Iranian and Sadrist, were going to take 80 or 90% of the vote at the election. He's now teamed up and become an ally of Muqtada Sadr. He represented for us the key challenge, which was working out how to deal with this kind of power figure. He clearly had an enormous amount of knowledge, an enormous amount of influence. Equally, he was clearly implicated in corruption, in nepotism, in violent strike-breaking, and the theft of ministry vehicles. So every day, dealing with somebody like that, we were trying to weigh up our real belief, which is that we needed to empower local political figures, that we couldn't afford to try to micromanage things ourselves, with the reality of our serious concerns about his human rights record and his competence.
And Paul Bremer appointed him to the 25-member governing council. So was that just a realization that this man had a lot of power, or was Bremer unaware of the negative sides?
I think it was based on a sense that this man had a lot of influence in southern Iraq and also on a sense that he was friendly towards the coalition. And indeed, in the early days, he seemed to be a very pro-Western figure. The challenge in selecting people, either for the governing council or in the work we were doing, which was selecting people for the provincial government, was that we were doing it without elections. And in retrospect, I think that was the fundamental mistake. We should have held elections much, much earlier. We didn't do so because people thought Iraq needed a long process of democratization and registration before the elections were held. But the result was the people such as myself and my American colleague were having to sit there and select who were going to be the figures on the council. And this meant trying to work out from the nearly a million people in that province who it was, and nearly 2 million when it came to Dhaka, who it was powerful, who was effective, who respected human rights, who was friendly towards the West. And often nobody had all those qualities. You had to choose between them.
Abu Hatim wanted to install his brother as governor of the province. Why didn't he want the job for himself?
I think he didn't want the job for himself because he had his mind on national politics in Baghdad and he thought he could control it through his brother.
My guest is Rory Stewart. His latest book, The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, is published by Harcourt. And we will continue our conversation after this. Rory Stewart is my guest. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Granta, the London Review of Books, the author of The Places in Between, which was an international bestseller. His new book is called The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, published by Harcourt. Besides the prince, who were the other major political forces in Maysan? You mentioned some of the outsiders like Muqtada al-Sadr, but were there other local leaders? Or were any of the Ba'athists, for example, still, did they have any importance?
No, there were no Ba'athists left in Maysan, and that wasn't because we had de-Ba'athified. That was because in the few weeks following the invasion, before the coalition troops even got to the province of Maysan, most of the Ba'athists had fled or been hung up from lampposts. They'd been lynched by the people in the province. This was a province which had suffered terribly under Saddam. You know, 150,000 people displaced. Almost everybody I dealt with had been imprisoned or tortured under the old regime. I think almost without exception, everybody had had a close relative killed under the old regime.
So you would have thought they would have welcomed you and the Americans as liberators. That's what many people in Washington thought would happen.
That's absolutely right. And it's a real lesson in how intrinsically unpredictable and chaotic these kinds of interventions are. I'm very much opposed to the notion that gets put around a lot today that somehow the problem was that we didn't do it right.
Paul Bremer is blamed for a lot of the problems.
Right. But even Paul Bremer's own analysis tends to focus on the modalities, as does, you know, Senator Clinton when she criticizes it, or even a string of recent books. They tend to say, okay, the idea was fine, it was just that we didn't get the planning right, we didn't get the tactics right, we didn't have the right people on the ground. My experience is that this adventure, this misadventure, was destroyed at a much more intimate local provincial level by the realities or the absence of local political structures and the daily interactions between Iraqis and the coalition. Essentially, we went in there with an extremely hubristic, overambitious vision, and we encountered a society in which Saddam had dragged all the power into the center. He'd completely disenfranchised almost all the local political leadership. You said earlier that you'd imagined it was a tribal society. Well, of course, the tribal chiefs again and again failed to really take authority. The time at which I saw this most clearly was in March 2004, where we held an election in a town called Al-Rafai in northern Dikar. It was a reasonably good election, rough and ready, based on ration cards, and in fact led by a very talented State Department colleague of mine. And the result of this election was 10 young men, most of them with engineering degrees from Baghdad University, non-tribal, non-political, being elected. And shortly after their election, in walked five militiamen led by a 28-year-old cleric who kicked them out of their office, abducted one of them, and tortured him. We asked the Iraqi police to intervene. There were 400 policemen there, and they refused. We asked the Italian military to go in, and when they went in, this 28-year-old cleric fired a rocket-propelled grenade at them, and the Italians went away. So we then tried to find a political solution. This meant sitting down with the headmaster of the local school, the imam of the mosque, the tribal sheikhs, the mayor, the police chief. And we began by saying, look, this is an embarrassment. You're a town of 110,000 people. You had an election which you liked. You've elected a good council, and you're failing to support it. What are we going to do about it? And the response to the headmaster of the school was, well, maybe we should just have a new election for a new council. So we said, well, not much point in that, is there? So I said to the tribal sheikh, look, you, Sheikh Talib of the Beni Rakab, you spent the last 6 months saying, give us guns, give us ammunition, this is a tribal society, we can keep security here, what do you need? And he said, oh, I can't touch this guy, he's not from my tribe. And finally the imam of the mosque said, Mr. Rory, this young man, this 28-year-old cleric who tortured this guy, he's had a difficult life. His father died when he was young. Can we not just forget about him? The conclusion I took from that is not that the people in that room did not understand the principle at stake. They all understood the principle at stake, but they simply had no faith in the system, could see no point in handing this guy over to justice, and had no wish to take political power or responsibility themselves.
So it's impossible to install democratic institutions in a society where they are rendered meaningless.
I think it's possible to hold elections, and we need to be honest about the fact that the government that we now have in southern Iraq is an elected government. It has many problems. It's a government that just killed somebody I knew well, a friend of mine, about 7 weeks ago, dragged him from his car and executed him because he edited a children's magazine and had once spoken in favor of women's rights. So militia connected to the elected government. So it's an extreme conservative Islamist government with very authoritarian tendencies. Nevertheless, it's elected. It is keeping order and security. And I think the only option we have now is to empower them and to allow this elected government to make their own political decisions and resolve the situation.
You decided to include the satirists in the council that you were creating over the objections of the Prince of the Marshes and others. And you're right, no one was going to thank me for bringing the satirists into the council, including the satirists who rather enjoyed criticizing from the outside. But you were just being realistic politically?
Yes. I think what I was acknowledging is whatever one thinks of the satirists, and the main reason why we, the coalition, didn't like them is they hated us and they were attacking us. But the fact is, when the elections came, the satirists got three times as many votes as the next largest party in the province. And it makes no sense to me whatsoever to try to exclude a group like that. And I see again and again our reluctance in Afghanistan, in Iran, in Palestine, in Lebanon, to acknowledge that conservative Islamist parties with extreme anti-Western agendas can be very representative and often very popular and powerful.
My guest is Rory Stewart, who's written a book called The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, published by Harcourt. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Well, you talk about all the mistakes that were made in misunderstanding the whole culture. What were your thoughts about the invasion in the first place?
At the time, I was in favor of the invasion, and that was because I'd served in Indonesia as a diplomat working on East Timor, and I'd served in the Balkans working on Bosnia and Kosovo, and I'd served in Afghanistan. And in each case, having been skeptical about a foreign intervention, I discovered that the local people appeared to be grateful that it had taken place, willing to cooperate, and that the people on the ground were better off after the invasion than before. So I assumed the same would be true in Iraq. I'm not sure that it was easy to predict the disaster. I know many people now believe that it was very easy to predict the disaster, but I think if you'd asked somebody in 2000 which would have gone worse, the invasion of Afghanistan or Iraq, it would have been very difficult for them to answer. Both countries are 20 million people, both with strong Islamist populations. Had Afghanistan gone worse, everybody would have said, of course Afghanistan went worse. This was a country which resisted the British in 1842, which kicked out the Russians in the 1980s. It's a highly mountainous country. It's got very extreme conservative rural population. And if Iraq had gone well, everybody would have said, of course Iraq went well. You know, this is a secular, middle-class, liberal country. It's a flat landscape. They were fed up with Saddam. So I don't think the prediction in advance was easy.
Although I've spoken to a number of people, including Tony Zinni, who was one of the most important generals in the U.S. military before the invasion. And he said that exiles warned them of all of the problems that followed, and they were just ignored when the United States and Britain went in there.
I disagree strongly with General Zinni. I found that Iraqi friends themselves were extremely unclear about what the reaction of the population was going to be to the invasion. I had Iraqi friends who said, we're a proud nationalist country. We will fight from the rooftops. You will have a 10-month siege of Baghdad. And I had Iraqi friends who said, nope, we're fed up with Saddam. People will be grateful that he's gone, and people will cooperate with the invasion. People said a lot of things. People predicted neighboring countries invaded. They predicted chemical weapons going off. There were a lot of doomsday scenarios. My belief, though, is that these kinds of situations cannot be predicted. Plans always have to go out the window because you cannot predict the reaction of the local population.
So what happened to the Provisional Council?
The Provisional Council is a very interesting example, right? The Provisional Council was mocked at the time. People said, why on earth did we choose this group of 25 people with Iranian connections, many of them exiles? However, as soon as the elections took place, an enormous number of these people, 80 or 90% of those people, have come back into office and now serve in government and in the cabinet. It turns out that, in fact, those people were powerful, effective, and representative figures.
And who became the governor?
The governor of the province, mm-hmm. the Prince Tamash's brother, became the governor.
As he wished.
As he wished. And then when the elections happened, the leader of the Sadrist party in the most extreme town in the province became the governor. And, of course, this was a man who we had pitched as our enemy. The coalition had decided to go on a counterinsurgency campaign against him, and then he ends up as the governor.
In a footnote, you write, I'm quoting, "In May, I was encouraged to spend $10 million in a month with almost no restrictions. Auditing systems were primitive, and the money arrived vacuum-packed in million-dollar bricks. We received so much money that it was impossible to spend it responsibly." Obviously, a system that invites corruption. Why was money running like water?
Money was running like water because the insurgency had got going, and people often think like Marxists. They often assume that despite the fact the crowd is carrying a banner which says jihad, death to the infidel, in fact the reason why people are attacking you is because they don't have electricity or because they don't have jobs. So the naive solution to this is let's throw money at the problem. Let's try to create economic growth. Let's try to give these people jobs, and then everybody will be happy. They won't attack us anymore. This goes back to the nature of the kind of criticisms which are made by a lot of the critics of the war, who somehow imagine that the reason why the Iraq intervention failed is that the administration wasn't organized enough to sort out the economic infrastructure. That wasn't my experience. My experience was that these people sincerely had political and religious objections to our occupation, and that the only solution to their concerns was going to be a political solution, and that needed to be one led by local figures, and it wasn't something that foreigners could really meet.
How much could you even understand of what was going on? You had to rely on translators, and you talk about how you couldn't always trust them to be competent and probably couldn't trust them to translate correctly simply because they had their own agendas.
It's extremely difficult to understand, but it's not primarily a linguistic issue. I had many colleagues who spoke very good Arabic and had served for 10 years in the Middle East. It's a question of the complexity of a society after 30 years of dictatorship. The problem was that even the Iraqi translators we were dealing with failed to understand this society, totally underestimated the support for the Islamist groups, totally misunderstood the nature of the tribal affiliations. It's this sense of complexity that I'm pressing, and that's where I disagree with General Zinni. I mean, he somehow has a notion that he understood Iraq. I didn't know any Iraqis who were able to predict exactly what was going to happen in a province like Misan.
It was quite dangerous, wasn't it? Weren't you at the UN building on the day that the bomb went off that killed Sergio de Mello?
Yes, I was at that building on that day, and I ended up under siege in my compound in Nasiriyah for 3 days with 100 mortars and rocket-propelled grenades raining into the compound every night, my civilian staff taking shelter in the office. The bodyguard team, I had 6 American and 6 British bodyguards on the roof with 50 cal machine guns trying to stop people coming over the fence to kill us.
And how did it finally resolve itself as far as you were concerned?
Well, that particular situation, that particular attack was finally resolved by air power, by something called an AC-130 Spectre gunship. But the curiosity, the absurdity of the situation for me lay in the fact that the man leading the attack on the compound was a friend of mine. He was a man called Asad Ghazi, in whose house I had recently had lunch. He'd rung me to say, get out of the building, and I'd said, no, we're not going to leave this building. We're supposed to be in charge of this province and administering it until the handover. This was a very nasty attack. It was an attack in which eventually an Italian soldier was killed, in which some of our people working at the gate were paralyzed from the waist downwards. But when I saw him 5 weeks later, Assad, who'd led the attack, came up to me, embraced me and kissed me and said, Mr. Rory, you are my hero. We're going to miss you. You've done an amazing job here. I love you. And I said, Assad, why were you trying to kill me? And he smiled and he said, Mr. Rory, you know, that was nothing personal.
Is that the reason you left, returned to Afghanistan?
No, I actually came out of that situation with enormous respect for the intelligence, the integrity, the courage, and the ability of Iraqis. I think the very sad thing that I'm observing now is what seems to me a very patronizing and dismissive attitude towards Iraqis from various administrations. I don't believe that we are what stands between Iraq and civil war. I believe in a number of complex ways we are what's contributing towards the civil war. And I think we need to find ways of allowing Iraqis to resolve the situation in a way that only Iraqis can.
Were there any lessons to have been learned from the British occupation of Iraq during the 20s and 30s? Because we are now talking about the lessons that we didn't learn from Vietnam.
Well, I think the great lesson to be learned is how unbelievably difficult these operations are. Again, I'd use that occupation to show that people who believe that the fundamental problem is planning, tactics, knowledge, information, ability, are wrong. In 1920, the British had a series of extremely competent and well-informed administrators, at least in theory. I mean, my predecessor in Alamara in 1916, Gerald Leachman, spoke fluent Arabic, was famous for being able to shoot a tribesman dead in his own tent without anyone raising a hand against him. He was succeeded by St. John Philby, who was the first man to cross the empty quarter of Saudi Arabia, who became the Prime Minister of Saudi Arabia, in Shatra, Bertram Thomas, in Dixon, in Nasiriyah, who went on in this essence to be the founder of modern Kuwait. These people often had spent 10 years serving as Indian administrative officers. They were totally untrammeled by any sense of guilt, media scrutiny. They had a lot of resources. They spoke fluent Arabic, and yet they failed. They failed totally. And it became clear by the beginning of 1920 that the only option available to them was to hand over power as quickly as possible to the Iraqi government. At a time when, remember, Iraq was a much simpler place than it is today, a much smaller country, a much more rural country, without any of the modern issues of nationalism and Islamism. So the conclusion I take from that is, do not believe that if you just have the right people, you can do these things. I'd like us to take the conclusion from this that situations exist such that any amount of planning, tactics, resources are not going to resolve them.
You founded an organization in Afghanistan, returned to Kabul. What does your organization do?
Well, I'm now living in Afghanistan, where the Turquoise Mountain Foundation, which is the organization which I'm running, is helping a community in central Kabul to restore the historic city. We're working to preserve buildings and to improve living conditions in a place that's threatened with demolition. We're training craftsmen, masons, woodworkers, ceramicists, and we're trying to support Afghan crafts in export.
Would an organization like that succeed in Iraq, or is it too early?
I think the best project we did in Iraq was of that sort. The only project I was really proud of in Nasiriyah was a project we set up for 200 street children to train them in carpentry. It was the one project where I really felt Iraqis supported the project, where the local Arab media stations would come and report it. And it's exactly that kind of project I think we ought to be doing, rather than trying to interfere in politics, of which we necessarily as foreigners know little.
Rory Stewart's previous book, The Places in Between, was called a flat-out masterpiece in the New York Times. His new book is The Prince of the Marshes and Other Occupational Hazards of a Year in Iraq, published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.